Hey everyone, in any series, it's really hard to make three smash hits. Just look at The Godfather or The Hemsworths. Today's book is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban by J.K. Rowling. May the odds be ever in your favor.
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father. I started reading Harry Potter when I was 25 and it was so good that I thought I'd missed out on other children's books, so I started reading more. Don't tell me how The Very Hungry Caterpillar ends.
And I'm David Vance. I prefer children's book mashups like The Very Hungry Games. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban is a 3,000-page Russian novel about the Moscow prison Azkaban, where Tsar Nicholas II sent his disgraced mistress. It won the Newbery Medal.
And this is the book pile.
So a quick reminder to please rate and review the book pile. We appreciate it a lot.
This is from Ben Witch. David and Kellen nail it every week. This is always good for a laugh. And then from Lightish, Lightish wrote, funny, informative, mostly family friendly, one of my new favorites. I have to agree with that.
I will say, we never swear, but we do find creatively innocuous ways to talk about some dark things sometimes.
Yeah. You and I are just joking about everything that we think is funny. There's nothing deliberate about this to make this like, this is a clean podcast or like, this is an adult podcast. We're just talking how we talk. I am hoping that for the most part, if there are any kids that are listening to this, that first of all, any jokes that are too dark, I guess my hope is that parents aren't explaining the dark jokes to their children. You see, what happened with John F. Kennedy was that he was in a convertible.
Also, Kellen's 9-year-old believes John F. Kennedy is alive and thriving in Bermuda. I realize that's a callback to a joke coming in the future, but this is the time travel episode.
Yes, that's a good seed you've planted.
Thank you. It probably goes without saying, but there are spoilers for Harry Potter in this episode about Harry Potter. Okay, our guest today is the very talented Natalie Madsen. She was a writer and actor on Studio C, a sketch comedy show with 2 billion views. She was a semi-finalist on NBC's Bring the Funny, and she's currently executive producer on the sitcom Freelancers. So, Nat, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, of course. Happy to be here. Big-time fans, long-time listener. Been listening since the beginning.
Since the
I really love this. I know a whole, I've loved the podcast because it just means I don't have to read the books.
That's why we love it.
It saves me a lot of time and it makes me feel smart, even though none of the thoughts or ideas are originally my own. So I
want to go ahead and kick off, Nat. I know that you and your family are huge Harry Potter fans, so I'd love to hear, just generally speaking, what's been your experience with the books?
I mean, like most people my age, I'm 31, almost 32. I grew up with the books. I was the same age as Harry when all the books were released. We did the midnight release party at Barnes & Noble. We dressed up. I have red hair, so I was always Ginny. And I still to this day, I am so annoyed with how they treat Ginny in the movies. She's so boring. And in the book, she's like an interesting character. I just read the first 4 books with my kids. We just finished the 4th one. My oldest is 8, so we're kind of going to press pause because the 5th, 6th, and 7th are longer, a little bit darker.
Yes.
So like, it's been so fun to reread it with my kids. But growing up, I'll share one Harry Potter story that I think my mom would kill me if I didn't share. I actually don't really remember it because I was very much out of it. It was the summer before I was going out to school to Utah for college. So I just graduated high school and I was getting my wisdom teeth out. And for whatever reason, I don't remember why, they didn't put me fully under. They just gave me an extreme amount of laughing gas, like a lot. So I was, you know, I was pretty high. And I don't remember, I really don't remember coming out of it too much. But my mom said I was really emotional. I was like weeping, like not just like some tears. I was like sobbing, like hyperventilating sobbing, just yelling at the nurses and saying, I'm supposed to go to Hogwarts, not BYU. And I was like panicked. Because I think I was going to go to college like in 2 or 3 weeks. And I was like, no, no, this is wrong. This is wrong. I'm not supposed to be there. I'm supposed to be at Hogwarts. I know it.
How disappointing would that be if, like, as an 18-year-old, an owl flies into your house with a letter and it's just your acceptance to BYU.
Or you've been waitlisted.
That would be the saddest thing. I remember as an 11-year-old just absolutely knowing it was coming and being sad when it didn't come. I was like, I should have worn for recording this. I have a sweatshirt that says Hufflepuff Quidditch team, and me and all of my siblings took the Pottermore sorting test. Mm-hmm. And we're all Hufflepuff, all of us.
No way.
And so one year for Christmas, my mom got us all like Hufflepuff Quidditch team. So like we can wear it and wear the, like there's six of us. So there's enough for the Quidditch team.
Wow.
We're all Hufflepuff. Isn't that crazy?
Don't you need seven?
I don't know. Do you need seven? Not us Thomases.
We don't need to go into this.
But anyway, I'm always very defensive of Hufflepuff. I feel like it gets a bad rap.
So I am too.
Oh, yeah. On this podcast.
Yeah. Let me tell you something about Hufflepuffs, my friends. They're loyal, caring, and hardworking. And their common room is right next to the kitchens. And it smells like freshly baked bread all the time.
The thing I remember about Hufflepuff is that Helga Hufflepuff said, "I'll take the rest."
And you know what? I would take the rest. I'd take whoever wanted to come. That's a very Hufflepuff thing to do.
I tested as a Ravenclaw, and having crapped on Hufflepuff, I think I need to point out that I also do wonder, are Ravenclaws actually smart? Because I never see a Ravenclaw do a smart thing in the books.
That's true.
Hermione's the top of the year.
I think about that all the time. I was just having this discussion with my son. He was like, why isn't Hermione Ravenclaw? She's really smart.
I feel like, Dave, if me and you were Fred and George, which Dave and I, we talk about this all the time. No, if Dave and I...
You know what? I kind of wish George and Fred had a podcast. It would be a fun one to listen to.
That would be amazing.
I mean, not now.
Oh. Oh, my gosh.
I feel like if Fred and George had a podcast, it would be like if Dude Perfect had a podcast.
I bet you're right.
but Dave,
Dude Prefect.
If you, that's such a Ravenclaw thing to come up with. If you and I were Fred and George, then we would say something like, the smartest thing Ravenclaws do is date Gryffindors, and we'd high five.
Kellen, since this is obviously an audio podcast, Kellen narrates us high-fiving a lot more than we actually high-five.
And Natalie, going back, I thought it was really funny to all the other redheads out there that you went immediately from, I was always Ginny because I'm a redhead, and it made me so angry. And immediately you talked about something that angered you.
What are you trying to say? I fit a certain redheaded stereotype? Is that what you're trying to say?
I mean, you said it.
No. You know what? Justice for Ginny is real and validated.
In the movies?
Yes. They just didn't give her any lines, that poor little actress. They cast that actress because she was young and redheaded and then didn't give her anything to do.
The poor casting director of Harry Potter, because you have cast these 9-year-olds who are going to be in your series for the next, like, 15 years.
Well, and honestly, probably at the time, they didn't know how long, right? Like, you don't know there's going to be 8 movies. You can hope or guess, but you don't know for sure.
It makes me sympathetic to when people got married in medieval times when you were, like, 12, and it's like, well, I hope this person turns out to be cool.
I fault J.K. Rowling with the casting, too, because she had it – I mean, she was a bit of a nationalist in the sense that she – had to be a British actor. So you're cutting out so much of a talent pool, especially now when you're casting someone who has to be a child actor who's good, who is also – has to be British, who also has to have red hair. So Ginny had to be like one of 4 people, because even then they're like, yeah, well, Irish people are redheads, but only people from England, from Mother England.
I know. Well, and isn't that like, isn't it funny to have that mindset when it's like you could just like wig a kid?
Natalie wigs her kids all the time.
All the time. No, like, I mean, like, my years of Studio C, I was wigged more than I wasn't. You know what I mean? Like, I wore wigs all the time. I had, like, dark hair constantly and stuff. So like, sometimes I'm like, isn't it funny how we get so like locked into like hair color, but it's like, oh, half the time you could just cover it up. It
I would love it at Studio C if the actual like behind your back, everyone was like, Natalie's so much nicer when she doesn't have red hair. So for this sketch,
as soon as we wig her, she's just not angry all the time.
I keep replaying that phrase in my head of wig a kid. It just sounds so ominous without actually being ominous.
You can wig a kid.
So help me, I will wig a kid.
Like, wig a kid is the new find me a switch, right? As like a punishment for a child. So instead of getting grounded or a timeout, like your little Trevor just has to look like Cher for the rest of the day.
I just love the idea of like, did you break this rule? Go get me a wig cap.
You both know my brother, Johnny, and he, as a kid, was very fashion conscious. And so sometimes when he got in trouble, my dad would make him go to school in a shirt and tie. And it would drive him crazy. Okay, without further ado, here are our favorite lessons from Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Okay, number one. Kill two birds with one stone. Also, when PETA made their list of animal-friendly phrases, they replaced that one with feed two birds with one scone.
Stop. Is that real?
Yes, that is a real, no. That's genuinely on their site. And it's way easier to kill birds with a poison scone.
Just the side-by-side of like a bird who meets an immediate death with a stone versus one who is now just sort of like clawing at the ground like for 11 hours because it's gluten intolerant. Like, tweet.
So JK, one thing I love about her writing is that she's really great at writing one thing that does multiple jobs. So I'll read a section from Ron's letter to Harry. Harry, this is a sneakoscope. If there's someone untrustworthy, it's supposed to light up and spin. Bill says it's rubbish because it kept lighting up at dinner last night, but he didn't realize Fred and George had put beetles in his soup. So I love this line because it's kind of doing multiple things. She basically took a clue and disguised it inside a joke. So the first time you read it, you're kind of laughing at Fred and George. The second time you read it, you realize that the sneakoscope's going off because Peter Pettigrew's in the same room. So it's doing both of those things. On top of those things, it's also doing exposition. It's characterizing Fred and George. And I also think that sneakoscope would be a cute name for the NSA. Imagine the hearing where someone's like, we need to cut funding for sneakoscope.
Yeah, I feel like jokes are a great tool for either sort of smoothing over plot holes or introducing foreshadowing without it sounding scripted, without it sounding too much like exposition. We've brought up or bringing in information that otherwise no one would just say. I think we've talked before about how when we first meet Jamie and Cersei and in Game of Thrones, it's when we first meet them, he goes, as your brother. And like, no one, like,
right. It's all like, of us have siblings. Starts with their, like, oh, hello, sister.
They could have, you know, fed two birds with one scone if they had a joke. There's like somebody walks by and sees them holding hands, and the person is like suspicious of them, like, hey, what are you two up to? And if Jamie was like, right, I'm in love with my sister.
Well, and she does a lot. She kind of has this running list throughout the book of sort of that double entendre or that multiplicity where the thing means one thing the first time you read it and then a different thing the second time you read it. Yeah. So first, the Grim is a death omen, and then second, it's a godfather seeing his godson. First, Sirius is trying to kill Harry, and then the second reading, he's trying to kill Scabbers. You see that same multiplicity in other fields. So Will Wright, when he designed SimCity, he did it so that when you learn one thing, you learn many things. So like when you're learning how to lay down road, you're also learning how to put down pipe. And you also learn in SimCity which kids are psychopaths. Anyway, for me, the takeaway is whatever your field is, ask, how can I kill two birds with one stone? How can I get good multiplicity in this field?
Or for PETA, how can I throw a scone really hard?
Yeah.
I think that's what I got from that. Number two, if your story has time travel, make sure we really care. So I think this is really important. And obviously this is a narrower lesson, but to me in stories, time travel, if you're going to bring it in, it already comes with plot holes by default, but audiences will be willing to overlook them just to go along with the ride with the characters if they love the characters. Bob Gale, wrote Back to the Future, he said the three things that matter most in a story are characters, characters, and characters. And it's so true. If you look at the case studies of Back to the Future, how we feel about those characters, you compare that to like Interstellar, which I'm a huge Christopher Nolan fan, but Interstellar is not great. Like, he does the opposite of Back to the Future, where he explains time travel and relativity like in a way that it could actually work. Like, he gets the science right, but nobody's wearing an Interstellar sweatshirt because no one cared about it.
It's interesting too, because when you think about Interstellar and time travel, it's also like what happens to the characters is really sad. Like, a father loves his daughter, but they can't really be together, and he tries to communicate with them. I'm a parent. I feel like I should have been more emotionally connected to that character struggle, but it was so much about the mechanics of time travel and not so much about the people.
Interstellar is absolutely that, where they start to go in the right direction, where it's just heartbreaking, and he's like, oh, you know, I might not see you for years, and when I come back, you could be older than me. And it just, like, breaks your heart. And then 10 seconds later, he's, like, on a spaceship, like, all right, so this is how black holes work.
Like, yeah.
Okay. Maybe you should have thrown the script in one. So Harry Potter is in the middle for me, because my first experience with Harry Potter, I was much older than you guys because I had gone on that interstellar spaceship.
You still are.
We'd like to point out that you're still older than us. Keep going.
Did I interrupt your joke?
With logic, yes. Welcome to this podcast.
Yeah.
So Harry Potter falls in the middle of this for me. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban falls in the middle of these two examples for me because of what I call the Goonies principle. So I didn't watch Goonies as a kid. I watched it for the first time when I was 22 with a group of other 22-year-olds who did grow up with it. I thought it was lame. It's not a good movie, but everyone else there had grown up with it, so they couldn't see it objectively, because if your first viewing of something is sort of branded in you emotionally. So Willow is my Goonies, because it's probably not a good movie, but I still see it through the eyes of me when I was 9.
That's me with Citizen Kane.
I have a Willow story. I had never seen Willow. My husband and their family grew up watching it like you. I've also never seen Goonies, so I need to watch it. But I had never seen Willow before, and I was pregnant with our first child a while ago, and we were at my in-laws, and we were like, let's watch Willow. Nat's never seen it. Let's do it. And I was like, yeah, okay. I was so stressed out about a baby in a backpack the whole time. I hated it. I was pregnant. And so I think I had like some hormonal, like I'm really worried about this baby. I can't even tell you what happened. That's the only time I've ever watched it.
So The Prisoner of Azkaban, I ended up on each end of the spectrum with following reads. Because the first time that I was reading the books, I was in my 20s. I'd finally gotten around to reading them I'd put it off because I thought, people, this is probably overrated. Then I did start reading them and found out that all the hype was absolutely warranted. I loved everything about it. So I didn't even think twice when I read through the third book. It was just fun, this going back in time to fix these problems. And there are these things that have been planted before to where everything just worked out so well in the end. So it wasn't until the second time that I read back through them where I was like, hold on, why aren't all the bad guys just trying to get time turners this entire time? Like, if this thing is accessible, then like Voldemort wouldn't be splitting his soul into toys. He would be finding something.
Just like turning. I have the same qualm with it. I feel like in Harry Potter as a whole, it's just not used again.
It makes it even worse in the fifth book when this entire time, like, oh, this weapon, what's his weapon? What's he looking for? That literally when they finally, the Death Eaters do break into the ministry, you have to walk past the case that holds the time turners to get to the prophecy. Like the prophecy, why was that thing the priority? It's also funny to me that after Dumbledore dies, I mean, this conversation didn't happen, but if it did, it would have been like, should we use the time turner on that? And Hermione's like, no, but it's a good thing I used it to get ahead in a class.
Yeah.
Muggle studies.
Because I think there's caution with using it because of like the butterfly effect or things that might happen or like people going insane. The thing that I, at least in the rereading this book, Prisoner of Azkaban with my kids and then watching the movie again, if Hermione knows that she's frequently using the time turner, wouldn't she like not go crazy seeing herself? she was talking about how like, people have gone mad because they've used the time turner so much. And it's like, but you know you're using the time turner. So isn't that not that confusing? Like,
you're forgetting the classic fantasy plot device of women be crazy.
Women be crazy. There's also the part where Dumbledore is like talking to, like locks him in the door. And all he says to them is, two innocent lives could be saved tonight. Three turns should do it. Bye. Instead of like, okay, this is what you should do. You know what I mean? Like,
it's almost like Dumbledore knows he's going to be in court and he needs to give himself as much deniability as possible. All right. Number three, create magic in the ordinary. So I think with stories, there's this division where some stories are more about the crisis and some stories are more about daily life. So take Hunger Games as an example of a story that's more about the crisis, and there are big Hunger Games spoiler alerts ahead. Most of the time we're with Katniss, you know, she's fighting for her life in the Hunger Games. She's fighting a war. She has to turn down one of the good Hemsworths because he kills her sister. Like, it's very much a crisis story. Most of the time we're with Harry, he's just at school. So here are some of the big plot lines in book three. Harry can't go on a field trip. Harry messes up at sports. Harry's friend loses a pet. Harry likes a girl he's never spoken to, which is very relatable. Harry's school gets menacing guards, which is also relatable. So a thing I love about Harry Potter is that we can spend so much time in his daily life because J.K. makes that daily life so interesting and magical. I have this theory also that we get to know characters a lot better in kind of the daily life stories than in the crisis stories. And obviously, like you said, the Harry Potter books do each build to sort of a crisis at the end. But Linda Seeger in the book Making a Good Script Great says, it's as if the character is too busy doing the plot to tell us much about himself or herself. And she says that basically sometimes you kind of need those slower subplots where characters can relax and sort of be themselves in order for us to get to know them.
Absolutely. I feel like we see this when they're in the Great Hall when they're eating, because oftentimes like Harry won't be eating because he's nervous about the upcoming fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. Hermione has her face buried in the Daily Prophet because she's a reader and she's up on things and she always has the latest news or facts that'll come in later, information that'll help later. And Ron is just an idiot stuffing his face with food. I don't like Ron.
Oh, Ron.
Really?
Other than the time turner, Ron doesn't need to be in the books either. You brought up the fourth book earlier. I just read the fourth book with my 9-year-old. Mm-hmm. And it does start to get dark in that book.
Yeah.
So that's where we're hitting pause. He doesn't know that Cedric died.
Wait, what?
Who doesn't?
Oh, you don't either, Dave? My 9-year-old, he doesn't.
You lied to your 9-year-old?
Right. So he's just
you skipped that part.
Well, I changed it so that Harry brought Cedric back. And it gets like harder. It got harder and harder to explain because how much there is afterward. Like Cedric's parents come. And so now they just had to come visit him while he was healing in the hospital.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, no. So wait, what happens to Cedric? What does Pettigrew do to him in your adaptation of Goblet of Fire?
Oh, he just like knocks him out.
Could he have just like stunned Cedric and still like come back?
Yeah.
Oh, that's even sadder.
I'm curious, for your 9-year-old, what happened on 9/11?
Oh, no. Don't worry. Cedric wasn't in the buildings.
But for me, the broad takeaway of this point of create magic in the ordinary is, I do think that that's something worth applying in our daily lives. The Heath brothers have a book called The Power of Moments, which is a great book. And in part of it, they say, essentially, life is mostly forgettable and occasionally remarkable. So we should invest more in making those remarkable moments. An example from my life, my sister Cassie and her husband Trent made this homemade escape room for the family over Christmas, and it was just incredible. Like, it took a decent amount of time to plan, and it lasted one evening, but we've talked about it so much, you know, so they just invested time in making a magical moment out of daily life, and it's paid such dividends.
Mm-hmm. In our family, we tried to do that in the beginning of the pandemic, because we just didn't know how long everything would be shut down. Like, we had a trip to Disneyland that was planned that we had to cancel. And so we decided one Saturday to just turn our house into Disneyland. Aww. And really all we did was like, YouTube is filled with videos of people that have like filmed going on a ride, right?
Oh, cool. Uh-huh.
So we would like put it on the TV and we'd sit in front of it and like lean with it and like pretend to be going down. And then I found a churro recipe online and tried to make Disneyland churros. It was really easy. And that's like all we had to do.
And you like, charged your kids $11 a churro.
Uh-huh. Yep. You better believe it. You gotta pull their weight. It's a good point where like you probably have more resources at your disposal every day to create like a memorable moment.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to do that the next time my kids ask to go to their grandparents' house.
just play a video of their grandparents.
Just wig a kid and make them the grandparents.
Just wig a kid and say, these are your new grandparents.
All right. Number 4, find seeds that you didn't know you planted. So again, this message is for storytellers, whether you're writing a book, a movie, or just making up a bedtime story for your kids, which I love doing. I used to tell my younger brother stories when we were growing up. I do it with my kids now, just once upon a time and go with it. And one thing that
I do that with my nobody.
Oh, man. This took such a sad turn. Like, now I'm just imagining like Dave hugging a pillow at night, and he's going, "Once upon a time, I had children." But a lot of times I will try, and if I haven't planted a seed at the beginning of the story that needs to come up at the end, then I'll just sort of think back and try and call back on something that happened before. It's basically a way of, if there's what you find like a deus ex machina at the end of your story, you can look for seeds that maybe you didn't know you had planted along the way. So I told them the story one time about how Prince Desmond, Prince Gibson, they get on their dragon who flies to the other end of the forest to save a tribe of gummy bears from fire-breathing chickens. And I had,
of course,
before they left, I had Prince Desmond grab a book on his way out because the dragon flight was going to be long and he needed something to read. So it turned out that at the end of the story, he pulls the book out and it's a magic book that has this power to blow all the chickens away or whatever happened, whatever. He opens the book and it throws scones to all the chickens. That was probably the end of it. But it was like,
so many chickens with that scone.
But it became satisfying, even as kids. Like, we just have this innate human response to like, oh man, I didn't see that coming, but it makes sense. I read this great advice in Writer's Digest one time that people want to try and predict the end of the story, but they never want to be right. So it's fun. It means like,
that's so true. That explains me watching any mystery I've ever watched.
Exactly. Like, you feel a little bit cheated.
I want to figure out, but I want to be surprised.
100%. And so that, like, if you want to figure out the end, it means that you've been engaged in the story. So you've done your job there as a writer. But yeah, there needs to be something, and often using one of these seeds that was planted earlier. And so I want to bring Peter Pettigrew to the table for this discussion, because the point to me here is that, like, J.K. Rowling is great at deliberately planting seeds, but I also feel like her other strength is to find things that weren't meant to be seeds in the first place, but bring them in as if they were the whole time. So, like, a good example of this in other stories is Darth Vader being Luke's father. That was not brought up in the first story. It was not, but they were able to mold it in a way where Obi-Wan was like, well, but
wasn't it planned?
It was not planned.
I thought Vader means father.
No, it does, but it's not in German. But it's not, I've done the research on this. Yeah. For the same reason.
So the first movie, it wasn't the plan.
It wasn't the plan until after the first movie that idea was brought up.
That's crazy.
That's why Ben Kenobi, he literally says in the first movie, he killed your father. That was the story. But it was close enough that Obi-Wan was able to say in Return of the Jedi, well, when I said that, what I meant was
more metaphorically.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good example of a seed that was unintentionally planted that they were able to find and mold. A bad example is Luke and Leia being sisters, which they wanted, like George Lucas wanted to have
sisters?
A twist in Return of the Jedi.
I like that you didn't say siblings.
No, that's the real story is
no, he's
that
dunking on
is
him.
They're sisters. That Luke is also a woman. They're siblings, which I never liked that twist. And it's an example of an unsuccessful attempt at trying to find a seed that doesn't really hold through, especially since they've kissed a couple of times at this point.
Yeah.
Luke should have been like, as your brother.
As your brother. I just feel like, at least with the Luke and Leia being brother and sister thing, it changes nothing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Like, great twist. I wasn't expecting it. And
exactly.
Let's just not talk about it anymore.
It's true. But it's like, so inconsequential.
But like, Vader's your father. Whoa, that changes your motivation. That changes your whole trajectory.
Oh man,
you know what I mean?
Like, I wonder, and this has probably already been done, but the last time I watched Return of the Jedi, I just imagine, like, after Luke says, like, you're my sister, Leia says, I know. Somehow I've always known. And then just have a, like, flashbacks of when they've made out.
And the Game of Thrones theme plays in the background.
Do, 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 do. So with Peter Pettigrew, what do you guys think of this idea? To me, I'm not convinced that he was supposed to be. Where are you on this? Do you think that Scabbers was supposed to be Peter Pettigrew from the beginning of the Harry Potter series? Or did J.K. Rowling just sort of, figure out a way to make this happen when she wrote this book?
That's an interesting question, because I do feel like we first meet Scabbers, like, right on the Hogwarts Express when we meet Ron, right? Like, Scabbers is with him. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember if Ron even talks about how, like, it's his old family rat. I don't remember when we learn that Scabbers has, like, been all the kids' pets. But they talk about it in the third book of, like, that rat is, like, 25 years old. He should be dead. Like, rats don't live that long. But it might be one of those things where she found that seed after writing the first book.
Where do you
I could see it going either way, because she did foreshadow so much from book one, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it's such a sprawling series. I could see it either way.
I guess
that just shows how good she is at it. Is that to me? I do see a plot hole there in that if, and I'm sure this has been brought up on way too many Reddit threads, so I'm not gonna go too deep. But I do wonder how Fred and George never saw it. If they've used the Marauders map so many times, how did they never see Peter Pettigrew, like, in their dorm this whole time? I am thinking too much about this, as I'm sure the three of us are with everything we're talking about this episode. But how great. I imagine, like, Fred and George, if they're sneaking out at night, they're looking at the map, and they've never wondered why Ron is always
with a guy
sleeping.
Named Peter.
Like, sleeping with Peter. Yeah. With another student. Like, for sure they would be teasing him.
Like, I have always wondered if the Marauder map just like, if it always shows people all the time, or if it's like, show me where Snape is, and then it'll pop up Snape. You know what I mean?
Maybe it doesn't display the names of its makers. No, actually it does. We know.
No, it does, because that's how Lupin knows that he's alive, because he sees it.
Yes, yep. Dave got something wrong. You're not
I corrected myself immediately.
It was just a guess. He didn't get it wrong.
Oh, don't be a Dave apologist.
I'm a very big Dave apologist.
That's another thing about the whole Peter Pettigrew. That's another miniseries I would hope gets made, is the story of the Marauders, like those four friends, and the story of them and Snape at school.
Oh, that'd be so
and Lily
fun.
And
I would be so much more emotionally invested in that story rather than, and this is just off the top of my head, rather than learning about wizards in America.
Yeah. Just off the top of my head. No, I agree. Because even the story of like Peter Pettigrew was their best friend. And he ended up being a Death Eater. Were all of them in Gryffindor?
I think so, yeah. Mm.
So, like, how did that, like, how did he turn and why?
I imagine the moment, like, for sure, Peter Pettigrew doesn't belong in Gryffindor. So I love the idea that as a kid with the hat on, right when the hat says, the hat is yelling out Hufflepuff, and Peter Pettigrew like yells out even louder, Gryffindor!
How dare you put Peter Pettigrew in Hufflepuff? How dare you?
I mean, I
don't. You're just trying to get me angry.
He's just not brave.
He would never be. I'm going to do research after this conversation and learn about how many Hufflepuffs became Death Eaters. I am willing to bet it is zero.
Because they don't have the ambition.
Oh my gosh. I'm so angry.
I do. Natalie's prequel idea, I want to see it combined with book three to make The Count of Monte Azkaban.
Yes, that's exactly what it would be. You're totally right.
All right, time for our random facts. So for me, one of my weirdest experiences happened with this book.
Oh boy.
So I'm driving to Krispy Kreme and I'm listening to book three, and I get to the part where Harry realizes that the voice he's hearing is his mom's. So my emotions are like a little close to the surface.
Yeah.
And I pull into the drive-thru and I'm so excited for my donuts. And then I get this text. Hold back on your laughs, because I get this text that a loved one just had a miscarriage, and I start crying. And then right then I have to pull up to the window and I'm like, crap, I know how this looks. It looks like I was having a bad day, so I came to Krispy Kreme for like some comfort donuts. I was having a great day, and then the bad day happened in your drive-thru.
I guess a convenient place to be at a sad moment.
Yeah. I did feel better after I ate the donuts, though.
So you ate a chocolate donut, just like how after you have an experience with a Dementor.
Well put. I was also like very conscious.
I do love that you put that in about Dementors, that chocolate is all you need.
That's so fun. Yeah.
That's like, oh, you got it. You got it, JK. You know what Dementors I'm dealing with once a month.
Oh, man. I am so going to use that now with my wife. Like, oh, sorry. Is it Dementor time?
Do not do that. You will get your head ripped off. Do not do that.
You will get your soul sucked out of your mouth.
You will get your soul sucked out. No chocolate can redeem you after that.
She wouldn't rip my head off. She's a brunette.
Oh, good point. Good point.
Do you have random facts, Kellen?
I do. J.K. Rowling says writing this book was the best writing experience she ever had.
Wow.
She says, quote, I was in a very comfortable place writing number three. Immediate financial worries were finally over, and press attention wasn't yet by any means excessive. So she wrote it before the first movie even came out, but she's finally like out of this starving artist desperation, and she could just sit down and write something with massive plot holes.
I think it's really interesting because you would maybe expect her to say something more like, by the time I was writing the seventh book, it was the most comfortable, or like, you know, like I had years of experience and tons of money, and I'd built this whole thing. And so I was very comfortable to write that. It's so interesting that you need both like confidence and security, and you're still hungry for something. Something I learned from a previous episode you guys did about Stephen King's book. Is basically how, like, if you want to be a writer, you should read everything. If you want to make TV, you should watch everything, because some things will be so good that you'll say, wow, I could never do that. And some things will be so bad that you'll say, oh, I could do that. Like, it gets you, or like, oh, I could do that better. So it gets you in this really good spot of, I feel like you need a good balance of humility and confidence to be able to really create in the best way. I'm sure that's kind of how she felt. We're like, okay, I have a couple books under my belt. I still have something to prove. But, you know, I'm not begging publishing companies to publish my first book and getting rejected a million times.
Yeah. And she has, at the time, had the additional luxury of relative anonymity. She
could. That's a whole other thing.
One of my favorite things that has ever happened to me, like, and Natalie, I know that you get recognized quite a bit, but it was something that's been new to me for the last couple of years, is every once in a while someone will recognize me from something that I've done, whether it's Conan or Drybar or all the other things that I've done, which are easily two more things than that. Someone will recognize me, but you know, it's once every, you know, when I'm in an airport or something, once every month. But one of the greatest moments, I was with a friend in a restaurant and someone came up to me and said, "Are you Kellen Erskine?" Because they never know how to say my last name.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes. And we took a picture, and it was fun to feel famous in front of my friend. But then, and this had never happened, this is the only time it's ever happened twice in the same day. So someone else came up to me 10 minutes later and we took the picture. And when that person walked away, it was so fun to be able to say, "I'm so sorry about all this."
I'm just like, oh, I just can't go anywhere.
My final random fact is that the writers of the Marauder's Map are listed in reverse order of their deaths. And also they were all murdered.
Whoa.
So I like their ability to turn into both animals and murder victims.
Oh my word.
Wait.
All right, should we end on that?
My brain just literally exploded.
Well, Natalie, thank you so much for joining us. This has been so fun.
Of course. I'm happy to chat with you guys anytime. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Natalie.
All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. 1, kill 2 birds with 1 stone. 2, if your story has time travel, make sure we really care. 3, create magic in the ordinary. 4, find seeds you didn't know you planted.
And 5, wig a kid.